Good evening, folks. My name is Norm Alvey, and I'm an alcoholic. And I certainly want to thank Bob and the committee for the opportunity to be here this evening and to participate and be part of the conference. I also want to thank the other people that made it so good after our arrival here. I'd like to thank Louie and his wife, and George and Carl and his wife, and all of the people that extended the hospitality to us since our visit here. Tonight, welcome to any new people that may be out there tonight for your first, second, or third meeting or first week or two around the program Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sure you're aware of the fact that you've made a giant step forward, that you've now associated yourself with one of the most popular, unpopular fellowships in the world. So nobody starts out his life wanting to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't think. I'm sure in my own particular case, I didn't go down to my high school counselor, and he said, Norm, what would you like to be? And I said, I'd like to be an alcoholic. He said, that's marvelous. We got a program here. And I went out and tore him up for 15 years and ended up in AA. No, there were other things that I would have rather done, but I can say this without any reservation whatsoever. If you got a drinking problem, you never have to take another drink again if you don't want to. What you're going to find here in AA is a group of people who will know most everything about you, will still accept you, who are not necessarily interested in where you've been or where you tried to go, but we're awfully interested in what you're trying to do today. And that's got to be a pretty good deal. And I speak only for myself. When I was out there drinking, nobody was really interested in what I was doing that day, unless they heard I was going to jail, and then they were delighted over that. Other than that, no, nobody really cared. So if you're new here tonight, will you come on in and grab this package? If you want sobriety, the sobriety is here. All you've got to do is pick up that telephone and make the call, and you're going to have all the help that you want. To qualify the beginning statement I made, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm not by any stretch of the imagination an authority nor a consultant on the program Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an example, good or bad, that AA works, that it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink, steal anything, or go to jail now for 18 and a half years. I don't believe anybody out there tonight is overly impressed with that statement, but I'll tell you one thing, man, I'm overly impressed with that statement, you see. Not only that, but you never... Thank you. Not only that, but you never know, we may get a pension program going here, and if we do, I'd like to get credit for all my time, you see. I'm sure to all the new people out there tonight, you find it pretty darn difficult to digest when you hear a guy say he hasn't had any booze now for 18 and a half years. If I'd have told you I hadn't had a drink for a couple of months, you'd have come up to me after the meeting and said, the hell you have, how'd you do it? So you can understand a couple of months, but it's damn difficult to understand a few years around. What you got to remember is I've been cutting it out there one day at a time, one day at a time, and the weeks run by and the years run by, and pretty soon you stand in front of a group of folks down in West Virginia telling them you haven't had any booze now for 18 and a half years, and it was like yesterday that I walked through the door and I sat there at that first AA meeting. I'm 29 years old, and I was wondering, man, why am I an alcoholic? And I wondered this for quite some time. I thought of all the things I could have been, why am I an alcoholic? You know, I come from a family of heavy drinkers. Everybody in my family drinks. We're Irish and Italian. That means, number one, you're not overly intelligent. Number two, it means you know a little bit about that booze. We know how to make booze and drink booze, and we're still out there making it and drinking it. But I turned out to be the only alcoholic of the whole family, and I sat there in those meetings wondering, why me? I'm the best they got in that family. I could have thought of a half a dozen other people that should have happened to. Today, I am delighted. My biggest problem is alcoholism. I am alcoholic because I drank too much whiskey. That's the reason I'm alcoholic. And I got a few other things going for me. I'm a rationalizer, a justifier, a compromiser, and I got a rotten attitude. And you don't need any more than that, you see. I've traveled half the world and half my life making a complete ass of myself out there. I spent money I didn't have buying things I didn't need, trying to impress people I didn't like. And that's the story of my life. I can sum it all up by I'm the guy out there in L.A. It's 105 in the shade. I'm driving around town in my car with all the windows rolled up because I want everybody to believe I got an air conditioner, you see. Any length to impress these people with this sense of well-being. You know, today when I drive around town in Los Angeles, when I see these guys with the windows rolled up in the car, you know what I think? Does he or doesn't he? You know, that lousy alky out there trying to impress me. As the story goes, you know, I spent a lifetime out there trying to be all things to all people. And I heard a story coming out of Texas that this guy didn't know it, but he told my life story. And I thought I'd repeat it tonight because it was clean and it had to do, you know, with the old blacksmith that was making the horseshoe. And he pounds out that horseshoe, it's red hot, and he throws it down the ground, and there's an old cowboy standing there watching that whole procedure. And the old cowboy reaches down, he picks up that horseshoe, and quick, he throws it down. And the old blacksmith turned to him and he says, hot, wasn't it? And the old cowboy says, no, it doesn't take me long to look at a horseshoe. You see? And I thought, that's the story of my life, you know. I've been out there justifying my existence to everybody for all the stupid things that I've done all my life prior to coming to this program. The guy says, Norm, you're laying on the sidewalk drunk there. And I said, no, I'm not. I like sidewalks. You see, that's why I'm laying here. All of my life, I run around trying to be all of these things, and frankly, I never knew what I wanted to be till I got to AA. Prior to AA, I felt I was the general manager of the universe. No wonder I had to drink so much. You know, it's a hell of a responsibility out there when you're managing all of these things. But come to find out, all I've ever wanted to be in my whole life is to be able to spend a day out there on those city streets just being myself. And if I don't get any more from AA other than that in sobriety, I can say without reservation, buddy, I'm overpaid. Because I've spent a lot of days out there in that city street, and all I've had to be is me. I haven't had to be all of these fellows that I thought it was so very, very important. For when I walked through the door into that first AA meeting, the guy says, buddy, you don't need to impress us here in AA because we've been impressed by experts at AA. And the reason we've been impressed by experts is because we are all experts here at AA. And if you don't believe me, ask the guy that's sitting next to you. I'm sure he'd be delighted to talk about it. Anything you want to talk about. And if you're talking about something he don't know about, he's generally going to say, yes, that's true. You see, the alcoholic. So I walk in here, and the man says, don't impress us. But I committed the cardinal sin like most alkies do. Earlier in the program, I mentioned to a fellow one night that I'd been in jail about 25 times, you see. And he says, man, I did that much in a year. So no matter where you've been, buddy, somebody got there long before you did. No matter what you drink, you're going to find people that drank a lot more than you ever thought was built out there. So if you do, you come on in and buy a piece of this program, this philosophy of this package. Take it out there to the city street, by God, and spend the day out there. Just being yourself, not having to compromise your life nor justify your existence. Just spend the day out there being you. And this is a gratifying experience for I as an alcoholic. Tonight I'd like to talk a little bit about what I was like, what happened, and what I've tried to be like today, what Alcoholics Anonymous means to me, and a few things that I've used to stay sober over a period of time. I don't talk about the joints and the jails, the booze I consume trying to impress anybody. I only talk about this because I don't know a better way to talk about the program. When a man says to me, how does AA work? To me, it works because it's one drunk talking to another drunk, and between the two of you, stay sober. What does a couple of drugs talk about? They talk about what they were like, what happened, and what they're trying to be like today, and some of the things that they, too, are using to stay sober. And so by doing this, I, too, get in another day of sobriety out there on that city street. You go back a little bit, I started going to jail in the middle 30s, not for drinking in the beginning, but for stealing. I happen to be a thief by trade. I'm an alcoholic by absorption. I opened up the Midnight Auto Supply out in the San Gabriel Valley. And what that consisted of in the beginning was kind of popping hubcaps. It was kind of a fun thing, and we found out we could make a little money popping hubcaps, and so we branched the operation out, and we started getting other accessories you'd get off of a car. Then it got to be such a job to gather up all that crap, we sold the whole car, you know, and overnight the thing really got going. I was considered one of the finest car thieves that ever came out of the San Gabriel Valley. And back there in the 30s, you had to have some hookers. You know, you really had to move to be rated up there in that top 10 because we had some reliable thieves out there. But this went on for a period of time of about 18 months. I was arrested. I stood in front of my first judge, and I was sentenced to do time in the Whitty Reformatory because I couldn't get along with the people out in the city streets, 7 years to be exact. Through the efforts of some people in my family, it never came to pass that I was to serve this time. I stood there in front of that judge when he sentenced me and felt that this was a bad deal. I've been able to rationalize things all of my life. I felt I'm really not that bad. It's the rotten people out there that are causing this problem with me. I stood out there and reacted to life and to living all of my life, yet I couldn't understand, you see, why these things happened to me. When they led me out of Whittier, I thought they were overdue. I thought I should have never been out there. I rationalized the fact that what I was taking was from people that could afford it. It kind of made me feel like Robin Hood, you know, steal from the rich and keep it. And that's the way I felt about it. This was the beginning. The attitude problem comes out, and nothing has changed, even though that I make a fall. Along about 41, Easter week, to the best of my calculations, the first time I ever drank or was drunk in my life. It was Easter week. It was Balboa Beach. It was a rendezvous ballroom, Stan Kenton and Padre beer, and it was a hell of a deal right from the start. I'm not alcoholic from the beginning. You know, I kind of worked at that thing. I moved out of Padre beer down to Rainier Ale into Tin High Whiskey. And when I got to that whiskey, I found the greatest thing made since money and women was that whiskey. Because it gets you there quicker. And I've been in a hurry all my life. And where I want to get to is up on that plateau where you got that buzz on. Boy, and you feel good. And you're all things to all people. I'm good-looking, well-built, intellectual, and wealthy, and I got the job done in 2 hours. And that's the best deal I ever had up to that time. Not only that, when you were drinking that 10 high, you never got the feeling you were being cheated. I don't know, as frankly,
I never drank or didn't know that 10 High was cheap whiskey till I got to AA. It's amazing, isn't it, how your education branches out. I also learned other good things about drinking cheap whiskey. One night a guy said, when you drink that cheap whiskey, when you throw it up, you don't lose much, you know. That takes an alky to figure that out. But that makes a lot of sense, sure. If I was out there drinking today and I'm drinking that $8 bourbon and you watch a Met baby roll up, whoa, $8, my God. That's enough to make you sick all over again to throw up $8, you know. I think that old 10 High was going for about 65 cents a pint at that time, and that, God, it was rough. It burned going and it burned coming up again. I can remember the first night that I drank it, the guy says, you want to drink it? This happened in the state of Oregon, and I never turned anything down in my life. I said, sure. And I took a long drag out of it, and God, it came, was coming back up, and it runs out your nose and makes your eyes water, and your buddy said, ain't that good, God? Well, girl, that's good. You know, you can barely breathe. It's a good. But I worked at it, and I can remember the day I could drink a pint of 10 High and never heave a drop, and I thought, there, you're there now. You have arrived. I had a couple of blackouts up in the state of Oregon. I might tell you why I was up in Oregon. I'd violated my probation in L.A. I got the heat on again and had to move out. And I went up there, and I was doing pretty well for a period of time, and I started to dabble again in the car business. And I got picked up, and I was given an alternate program. You see, my life seems to be filled with alternate programs. They said, you can either go to jail or you can get the hell out of state. So I went out of the state because I'd been to jail. I went back down to L.A. I checked through the probation department, and they had another program laid out. They said, you can either go into the service or you can go to jail. Well, that's really not much of an alternative there. But I mentioned I'd been to jail, so I selected the United States Navy. What had happened to me, that was another one of my bad decisions. When I got into the United States Navy, all of the enemies I had in L.A. had joined the Navy the same day I did. They started telling me what I was going to have to do and all of the problems and all of these things went on, and I didn't particularly care for it. I went into the United States Navy with great aspirations. I felt I'd probably be the youngest lieutenant commander the Navy ever had. As it turned out, I was the oldest seaman they ever had, you see. I just couldn't get the thing off the ground. Every time I turned around, I was having some trouble. In 4 years, I had 3 court-martials. I had a deck of summary of general. I had 11 and a half months in a Navy prison up there in the top of Gold Island run by the Marine Corps. I won't even get into that. That was a bad deal. I had maybe 60 or 70 days in solitary confinement on bread and water. I had maybe 10 or 15 captain's masts and some other miscellaneous things that aren't important, but they're all directly to the booze now. If I'm not drinking, I'm not having a lot of trouble, but if I'm drinking, I got more trouble than I can take care of, but yet I refuse to relate it. I felt sincerely that I was a victim of unusual circumstances. And once I got out of the service, this thing was going to be all right. And so I was discharged in Christmas Eve of 1945. And in Christmas Eve of in 1946, I came back to Los Angeles. I came back to Los Angeles, and I had a lot of good intentions. And you and I know that hell is filled with good intentions. I was going to go back to school and fulfill my education that I'd thrown away. I was going to make amends and restitution and on it went. But in 1946, I couldn't get the thing moving. I was always going to do it later on or tomorrow or pretty soon, but the booze was interfering. 1946 is one of those significant years in my life. Every alcoholic has a year that plays a bigger part, I think, than others. Prior to coming to the program, it kind of leads you or channels you this way. As you and I know, God moves in strange and mysterious ways, and no matter what you do or you don't do, buddy, that's the way it's going to work out. Well, in 1946, there's a little town out in L.A. called Pasadena. I hated Pasadena, and it was a mutual agreement. They hated me. I used to think they had an alarm system went around the city limits, and every time I'd cross over, it'd go off, and he'd say, he's in there, you better get him. They got me again. That year before spring and tall cotton, well, they got me 5 times. The 4th time they picked me up was on my 2nd drunk driving. I stood in front of a judge that I knew like my old father. This judge and I'd kind of grown up together. I met him when I was a delinquent, or whatever we were then, thieves and drunks. I met him later on when he was sitting on the police court, the municipal bench, and he was a smart operator. He moved right along, and he got up there to the Superior Court bench. And I'm no meathead. I'm right with him again, you know. So there we are. I kind of had a sense of well-being between the two of us, going along together, you might say. I didn't feel that until after I got to AA. Anyway, this judge I went in front of the 4th trip on that 2nd drunk driving, he looked down at me, and he said, a year suspended, 3 years probation. If you get caught drinking in this town, you're going to do a year. Well, I'm about a half-smart alcoholic. And I said, well, this won't drink in his town. I'll drink out there on the perimeter. It's all going to be all right. This went on for a couple of months. It got so good, I couldn't stand it anymore. You know what prosperity does to an alcoholic. I'm 70 miles away one evening, drinking with a couple of fellas, and I committed the cardinal sin. While I was drinking, I began to think. That's a bad deal. You know it and I know it. You should either drink or think. You should never get them both going at the same time. I got to thinking about that judge and that rotten town, and this is a free country, and God knows I'm a veteran. Well, you've rationalized that out. What's left to do to get my car? I drove some 70 miles back to the city. I got a total load on. I went down one of the main drags. A car pulled in front of me. I was a drunk. I couldn't see it and hit it and ran from the scene of the accident. 3 blocks down the way while they're picking me up. Booked me in the felony tank on a 501 felony, drunk driving, hit and run, bodily injury involved. Went down in front of the judge the following morning, and I was dying 1,000 deaths, as you do. You know, all these stories you hear about these guys, what they told the judge. I told that judge I did. Yeah, you told him. You told him like I did. Give me a break. That's what I told him. Yeah. Anyway, he looked down at me, and he said, to the city jail to do the time. And in that city jail, in 1946, I heard about AA. There was 200 guys doing time in that can. There was one guy got out of the bucket once a week to go to AA meetings. Guess who I'm pulling the time with? This fanatic that goes to these AA meetings. Out of all of the other people that was there, out of all the other jail cells that I could have selected or they could have selected for me, no, it's this one here. A guy named Sullivan was getting out of the can. He'd go to these meetings. He'd bring this back, and he'd sit there once a week, and he was just dying to talk to somebody about it. Well, you don't have a big audience in a jail cell, I'll guarantee that. And I would sit there that once a week, and I would listen to all of this and to go in one ear and out the other. And he finally suggested I go to a meeting with him. And I said, Sullivan, not me. My problem's not booze. It's the rotten people. Not only that, I'm too young to be an alcoholic. Your case is altogether different. Got a guy as old as you are, what difference does it make if you quit drinking? Hell, you're 36 years old, buddy. You know, you're over the hill. You might as well throw up the booze, too, but leave us out of it, will you? No, no. I went on out, and I left the city jail. And the significant part of it is that the seed was planted. I didn't know it, and he didn't know it. But the old man upstairs, he knows all about this deal. And when the day arrived in my life that I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, I picked up the telephone looking for an outfit called AA and a guy named Sullivan. I never found Sullivan, not in a sober sense. When I located him, he was in Camarillo Hospital with a wet mind because after 3 years of sobriety, he went back to drinking and he couldn't quit. And he cut it before he was 40 years old, to the gates of insanity or death. They talk about it. It's in this chapter 3 in Alcoholics Anonymous book. But yet when you see it, and as many times as I've seen it, it's still so very difficult to believe that anything that tasted as sweet as whiskey could tear a man up that bad. But there it was, the man that introduced the program to me. In the following 8 years, after I left that city jail, I worked as hard as I could to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to work for one of the largest construction firms in the world. I stayed with these people 11 years. In that 11-year period of time, I was at the right place at the right time and ended up with a pretty good job. And a good job is a necessary part of my life because I'm a bar-drinking alcoholic. And a bar-drinking alky packs a big overhead. It's not like being a home-drinking alky. A home-drinking alky carries a low overhead, but I never liked that home-drinking. Who's there to tell how good you are? My wife, and she don't believe it anyway, you see. An alcoholic can't reach his full potential, I don't think, if he doesn't get out and circulate out there in them joints out there. I like them bars. I like the dark lights. I like the rotten music that hammers at you. I like the smell that hangs in there. You know, if you got a sinus problem, you don't need the desert. You just sit down, suck that baby in, and it blows everything out, you know. But more than anything else, I enjoyed the intellectual giants I met in them places. Where do you find the big money? Man, you find it about midnight sitting on any bar stool all over the world. We're the giants of industry. We're talking in millions and spending in thousands. We don't have five between us. And we're wondering what all of the poor people are doing tonight because the big dough's there. We build the castles in the air and form the corporations and lie a lot to each other. And when you get tired of talking and lying, you can look in that mirror. You know why they put mirrors in bars? They put them there for alcoholics. So about 1 o'clock in the morning, you can sit there with that perpetual Maybelline look, that wide eye, you know, that only the alcoholic can get. There you are, you good-looking devil, you. Oh, yes, and as you're bringing that drink up, you kind of look at your arm, and you, Jesus, how well-built can one guy get, you know? Yeah, you're sitting there, and you're wondering why all the dollies aren't down there with you, because you got it all going. You're good-looking and well-built. You got a $30 smiling Frankie Gordon suit on. You got a dollar's worth of whiskey right down the front of you and a little chili on your tie. You smell bad and you can't talk, and I'm one step away from disaster. If I got to go to the men's room, it's all over. There he goes, you know, yeah. Boy, isn't that a big step from the bar down? Now, over here, the lover of the San Gabriel Valley. Or you make some cute remark to the bartender, I'm now opening the door with my head again on the way out into the gravel parking lot to tear that baby up, to get the pavement rash. Alcoholics have a lot of pavement rash. It's all down just from having their heads in gravel parking lots. Then crawling out of the gravel up into your automobile to lay down to go to sleep. Yeah, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, is filled with car sleepers. You can always tell a new man if he's done any recent car sleeping. He sits in his first meeting like that, you know. Oh. From having your head screwed under the armrest all night and the door handle stuck in your ear. And when the sun comes through the windshield at 6 o'clock in the morning, that's called a spiritual awakening before AA. That baby hits you right in the eye and brings you to attention there in the front seat. You look down at your dashboard and you threw up on it again, didn't you? Or did you ever think the window was down? It was up. Blah, all over that. And yet you sit there thinking to yourself, I am having a good time drinking, though. Yes, I am, by God. It's that rotten whiskey they got in L.A. I got to get the hell out of L.A. That's what I got to do. I got to get back down to Big Spring, Texas. God, did they love me in Big Spring. Or was it Dallas they loved me? Or El Paso or Moses Lake, Washington or Seattle or on one? You know deep down inside. Deep inside you know. Nobody loved you. You were to the point of no return. You'd passed and crossed that invisible line years ago, and you probably knew it deep inside. Many times now, people would say, Norm, you're drinking too much. If you don't quit drinking, you're going to tear up your life. But I'm out there thinking, no, someday I'm going to control it. Someday I'll drink like my old man and my brothers and my friends. I'll find the answer to living in a quart of whiskey. Yes, sir, out there somewhere, it's going to happen. And I kept at it. In this period in my life, I had married through the advice of some very dear bar associates who had told me my major problem was that I was single. And that once I got married, everything was going to be all right. They said, now don't go off half-cocked on this deal. Find you a woman that's got a decent job, you know. So me and this red-headed Irish woman have been running around together. We decided to turn the trick and we got married. Now she has got a good job. And we had been married for 3 months. And she walked in the house and she says, Norm, I've been to the doctor and I'm pregnant and I got to quit work. It was like the whole house come down on me. I found that very difficult to believe. You know how it is going against an old alcoholic out there. I don't want to believe that. But she assured me that this was the case, and so you become fairly big-hearted. You say, well, that caper takes about 9 months. I'll give her 2 to get on her feet. We'll get the rotten job back, and everything's going to be just like it was. Isn't that the story of our life? Everything's going to be just like it was. Hell, that was 25 years ago. That woman ain't turned a tap since that day. She got herself in that shape 8 times. I couldn't believe it. Sitting on that bar stool and you're discussing the problems with your friend saying, you know, I can't make a bar bill anymore. Jesus, St. Luke's getting another one. And I'm rarely home anymore either, you know. And on this thing's gone. Being married to a red-headed Irish woman has great disadvantages. She's 5'3", weighed 115 pounds, and had a violent temper. And when I was drinking, she frightened me. Out there drunk for 2 or 3 days and you come home. And if you've been out there drunk for 2 or 3 days, you're tired. You've been busy out there. And you're tired, and you're a little sick and a little junky, maybe. And you walk in the house, and you'd like a little love, affection, and understanding, because you've had a hell of a time out there. And I'd walk through the door, and 25 paces away, she goes, you're drunk again, before she smelled my breath. And I would stand there and give her that logical answer. Who, me? Like 30 guys are with you. You know who the hell she's talking to. But you got to get her on the defensive. You see, that's very important. So you hit her with that big $64 question. You say, woman, do you know who you're talking to? Doesn't that get him right there, though? And then she'd mimic me as only them Irish can do it. Do I know who I'm talking to? In case you didn't, you introduce yourself to her. Sometimes this happened when you had one of your best friends with you. That's your new business partner you met in the bar last night. You've invited him home. The reason he's coming home with me is, hell, he don't want to go home alone either. You know, I've been on both sides of that deal. So there you stand, the blind leading the blind. He's going to tell her again, Norm, buddy. You know, you were just going to die. And I would have to get her off the defensive. So I'd say, woman, you've embarrassed me in front of my best friend. And then I couldn't remember his name. And if you don't apologize to me and my best friend for what you've just said, I'm going to have to leave. Yes, again. And this time's going to be different than all the other times. I'm not coming back. How do you like that? She was hysterical now as she walked down the hall and threw all my clothes out. Well, you pick up all the clothes and I'd carry them out to the automobile. The clothes-packing alcoholic, he's the joy to all neighborhoods he lives in. You see, when you get tired of watching the late show, you can stand out there on your porch and watch the old alky stagger in and out of the house, you know, that armload of clothes packing him in the backseat of the car. Some nights you get a real show. Some nights he comes out there without his pants on, just in his shorts. You know, here he goes. Yeah, what could be greater than a turkey-kneed alcoholic in the middle of the lawn, you know, with that armload of clothes? Put him in the back of the car, driving off, saying, I'll never be back. That lousy woman, she doesn't know what she's doing to me, and I'll never be back again. 3 days go by, and you have no place left to go. And you think, one more lie, one more promise, maybe. Yeah, she's gonna open that door for me. So you drive on home, sick. Maybe you got a flat tire before you got there. Sunday afternoon, it's a pleasant time for the alcoholic to come home. Everybody's out working in the yard. But you, here you come down the street you live on with that flat tire. Too drunk to change it, so you drive on it. The rim drivers, they call us today, eh? The old tire flopper poppers. Here you come, and the sparks are flying off of the rim, and you're coming down the street you live on, and if you can see them, they pop, there he goes, you know, yeah. You turn that car into the driveway, park that baby up on the lawn, open the door, and fall out there. There you lay. And getting up off of the lawn, the first thing that come to mind would be, I wonder if anybody saw me. Yeah. If you're a true alcoholic, you think nobody knows you drink. And you rationalize the fact, well, if they saw me sleeping on the lawn, they probably thought I had the flu, because flu's good for lawns, or vice versa. Yes, we're the only people that know all these things. But always in the back of your mind, no matter what gyrations you've got to go through, you walk into the house and you think, this time is going to be different. And you tell her, this time, baby, it's going to be different. I'm going down and see that other priest talking about and take another pledge. Pledge number 73. Or I'm going to that doctor and I'm going to talk to him about this problem. And I'm going to do all these things. And give me a break. Give me a deal. Sometimes you get right down to that third act and you cry. You just, hey, Jesus, think of the kids. God, don't throw me out. But if you drink enough booze, long enough and hard enough, the day comes when the whiskey takes away every loving thing you got that means anything in your life. The day arrived in my life when I come home and I find out I no longer live there. That all of the possessions I had was packed out there on the porch. And she says to me, she says, Norm, you get the hell out of our life. You're a drunken bum. You'll never live to be 35 years old. You're drinking yourself to death. I'll always love you, but you tore out all the feelings. The kids and me were neurotic because of you. I'm scared to death of you. I never know how you're coming home or when you're coming home. You're going to walk through that door again, and you're going to have that loaded 25 automatic, and you're going to put it up against my head again, and this time it goes off. You're going to bust up the furniture and shove the refrigerator through the wall. You're going to make the kids cry some more, Norm. Is that what you're going to do? You get the hell out of our life. I sit on no more couches all night long waiting for you to come home. And every time I hear a siren run down the street, I think, my God, the police got you again. And this time they found you dead in the middle of the street, and you're never coming back. Norm, you get the hell out of our life. And I walked out and I drove away. And I said, like every alcoholic before and after me, said, why me? How can this happen to me? It can happen to Charlie and Bill and the rest of the guys, but how can it happen to me? You and I know if you drink enough booze hard enough and long enough, it's almost got to be. Sure, there's isolated cases where people put up with this crap for 30 years. Always hoping this jackass is going to straighten out. 30 years, you know, flopping in and out of the house. 30 years of picking up the pieces. 30 years of lying for them. 30 years of them promises I know damn well they can never make to hang around. Hell, I wouldn't put up with it 30 days, let alone 30 years. God gives them a lot of strength, but it's a left-handed thing he hands down to them, isn't it? Yes, sir. But thank God he does, and thank God it happens, and thank God that God moves in strange and mysterious ways. Because this is one of the greater miracles you see in AA. When you see a man walking through the door and he's got his woman with him, and he's all torn up, and it's his first meeting, and he's sicker than a horse. And you look at the woman, and she's sick, too, and in a different way. And in his eyes, it says, geez, I hope I got a chance. And in her eyes, it says, this guy's tried everything there is. And none of it ever worked, and I'm sure this isn't going to work either. Now, a couple of months run by, and you see the same couple as they walk through the door. And the guy's sharped out, and he looks pretty good, and his eyes are clear. And the woman, she looks different, too. And you look in her eyes, and in her eyes, the story has changed. And it says, you know something, Norm? I've been waiting 15 years for this to happen. And finally it's happened, and we're happier today than we've ever been in our life. And this has got to be a miracle, and we choose to call it Alcoholics Anonymous. To the new people, we can't guarantee your woman's coming home or the woman's going to stay. The only guarantee we can give you is sobriety and a way of life, buddy. And if you're a ditch digger, you're going to be a better ditch digger.
you'll buy the total package of Alcoholics Anonymous. Losing a family wasn't enough to keep me from drinking. I had to lose the respect of the people I worked for. I had to go through the day when the old man called me and he says, Norm, the next time I catch you drinking on the job, you're through and out. And Norm, you never leave L.A. County for us again, never. We'll send the guy out on these jobs half as good as you think you are. At least we can depend on him. At least we know where he is. We don't have to send any money to get bailed out of trouble and jam. No more. Humility, I felt again. Alcoholics could write volumes on humility because they've been humiliated so many times. I was humiliated with what he had to say. But I didn't stop drinking. I didn't stop drinking until a man walked into my life and he said, Norm, you've abused the privilege of owning it. We're going to have it. And he took it away. My self-respect. The day you stand there and recognize you got no self-respect, that becomes, I've got to believe, the psychological second in your life when you're so damn sick and tired of being sick and tired, you're willing to go to any length to change it. The day you stand there and it's not important what people know about you. The only important thing is what you know about yourself. You know deep inside you can kid every man jack in town, but you can't kid yourself. That it becomes damned important. That day, I gotta believe, was February of 1954. I got up off the lousy floor, and I truly was sick and tired and didn't know it. And I was tired of hurting myself, and I'm willing to go to any length if somebody will show me a better way to operate. And I called the central office in Los Angeles, and I talked to a guy that was tending the phones over there. And God love him, I'm sure he won't mind me breaking his anonymity. His name was John Carroll. John died after he'd been sober 2 years. The reason John was a great man is he'd learned early in his AA life, in order to keep what I have, I got to give it away. And he gave it away by the ton. He worked at that central office for beans 7 days a week, giving away what he'd found. That day when I called, he said, you got a drinking problem, son? I said, I got a problem. You want to do something about it? I do. He said, here's some numbers. You keep calling these numbers until you get a guy. And if you don't get a guy on these numbers, call me back. I'll give you some more. Well, the second man I called, he was home. He said, I'll be out in 2 or 3 hours to see you, and he came. My sponsor was one of these sponsors you hear about, hard-hearted sponsor. Went to school for hard-hearted sponsors. You know the type. Comes in, and he sees you got a wristwatch. He says, you'll never make it. Now, you got to go back out again. That's the kind of guy. God, did I dislike him. He walked in and he sat down there and he told me all these terrible stories about himself. He talked about coming to the program, what the program has done for him. The only thing I agreed upon was when he said, if I can make it, you can make it. And I thought to myself, that's true. If that old jackass can make whatever you got to make, anybody can do it, Joe, because he was a dirty old man and I didn't really like him. He said, you know, I don't pick guys up and take them to meetings. I don't believe in it. No. You go out there, if you got a car, you get in your car and you drive down to the meeting and I'll meet you there. If you haven't got a car, you're going to have to take the bus. If you haven't got a bus, buddy, it's a hell of a walk, but that's the way it is, you see. Well, I had a car, by God. And that was another disadvantage early then. You know, coming into AA with a car in those days, in the part of LA I came into, you know, this was a disadvantage. You say, what do you mean they haven't repossessed your car yet? Well, you probably have to go back out, you know, and on it goes. Well, anyway, I met my sponsor down at a group called the Temple City Group. The Temple City Group met in Rosemead. Guys from El Monte, Baldwin Park, Monrovia, and Azusa used to go there. Nobody from Temple City ever went to that group. No. You know, AA is so damn mixed up in everything they do, you see. And it's so confusing. But the important thing is, it works. Well, that Temple City group that met there in Rosemead, we burned that baby down, and they moved to Arcadia. I just passed that on, you see. In the event you're looking for Temple City, don't go to Temple City, go to Arcadia. Anyway, this was the group that I was introduced to. There were 85 or 90 of the finest drunks that ever came out of the San Gabriel Valley. I walk into the meeting, and this was a very wealthy group. We had so much money in that group. In those days, we used to have donuts before and after the meeting. Can you imagine anything like that? They'd buy a half a dozen jelly donuts. And they'd, you know, the alcoholic, after he gets sober, gets a warped sense of humor. They'd buy these jelly donuts, and they save them for a new man. And they'd see a new guy coming through the door, and they'd go up and shake your hand and say, God, we're glad to have you. Have a cup of coffee, and here, a jelly donut. I don't want a donut. God. You're looking down at something you left on the street last night. And they would all get hysterical over it. Hey, did you see him? I thought he was going to die when we gave him that donut. Very funny. I didn't think it was too funny. The cliche of this group. We used to have a liquor store on the corner, and then a meeting hall, and then the cemetery. And they used to say, if you get by here, and you get to here, you won't get there. You know, and then they'd go out and show you that damn cemetery. And they'd all laugh about it. And I didn't think any of it was very funny. They all talk at the same time. All alcoholics all talk at the same time.
I'm standing around in a circle of a half a dozen people, and they're all talking at the same time. Nobody ever gets to finish anything he's talking about. Every time a guy gets down to the punchline, somebody interrupts him there, you know. You spend a lifetime suspended waiting to hear an end to one of those stories. Then you hear that phrase, keep coming back, and you think that's why they're telling you, keep coming back. Someday you'll hear the end of one of these stories, you know. Everything in excess. Drink more booze, drink more coffee, smoke more cigarettes, interrupt more people, and on it goes. But it works. That's the important thing, is that it works. The meeting began that night. A Los Angeles Central Avenue group put the total meeting on. A man stood up in front of that meeting that night and he told who he was, what happened to him, what the booze had done, what Alcoholics Anonymous had meant to him. He talked about going to these jails and these joints and all of these problems that were happening. And every time he talked about going to jail or somebody beating him up, well, the audience would laugh. And the more he got beat up, the more they'd laugh. And he talked about drinking Jamaican ginger, giving the Jake leg, crippling him up so bad to put him in a hospital for 2 months. Hysterical over that. Boy, you're sitting there and you're a new guy and you went, what the hell's going on here, you know? The guy's suffering and all they do is laugh. The bigger the bum, the more the laughter the guy gets. And then he came to the part in his story where he found this program and bought the package and his life began to change. And he made the transition. And in his family, in his family. Could only happen here. His family, who had divorced him, they did not become reunited because his wife had remarried. But the children of the marriage came down to see him over a period of years. One by one. In the beginning, they learned to like him. And then they learned to love him. And then they learned to respect him. And had I had the foresight that night to look around, I'd have seen a half a dozen guys sitting there, I'm sure, in that group. Big, tough, hard-drinking, hard-talking alcoholics with the tears running down the cheek. They were happy because he was happy, and so they cried. The story, as I understand the story of AA, was told that night. I've heard it hundreds and hundreds of times. They laughed because they were miserable, or they cried because they were happy, or they called it AA. How do you clear away the wreckage of your rotten, lousy past? How do you move that crap out? Boy, you learn to laugh a little, and in spite of yourself, you folks that are new, you keep coming to the meetings, and the night's going to come when you're going to laugh. You don't want to, but you will. Don't let them see me, you know, but it'll come. And the laughter starts to come out, and the wreckage of the past, and you clear it out, and you start to live one day at a time. And then the big day comes in your life when you make the total transition, when you buy the package, you go for the way of life. And the way of life is the day that you stop taking and you start to give. The giving of Alcoholics Anonymous. The no compromise kind of giving, the kind you can't bend and twist and turn to your own use. The giving for the pure hell of doing it. Maybe it's the night you're sitting there in an AA meeting and a guy stands up in front of the group and he's telling his story and you get choked up and you cry a little bit. And you're happy because he's happy. You give yourself. In your life, you never give nothing to anybody. I never did. I'm a taker. I laid out on that street and I stole every loving thing there is. I thought I had the key to happiness out there. Hell, I never had the key thing. I never knew what happiness was all about until I quit taking and I start to give a little. Give just for the hell of it. The no compromise kind. The picking up the ashtrays. The central service, general service, institutional work, dozens of ways that you can give to yourself for the pure element. And in it, the reward. The man says, you're talking how good it is. You're talking about this change and this transition. Well, what do you get? You get the thing you've been looking for all your life. You get a sense of well-being. That's what I looked for in that booze, was that sense of well-being. I drank myself up to that plateau to get that buzz on, to feel good, to have one more just to stay even, but I didn't, and I come down the chute. And in the morning, I woke up, and the sense of well-being was gone, and a friend of mine was back to see me, called remorse, and he just hit, and he tore my guts out. And I traded that. I traded that for the sense of well-being I felt in Alcoholics Anonymous. The feeling you get when you give just a little to that guy out on that 12-step call for the hell of doing it. And I know deep inside, and the end result when it's all over, when you're standing there and they're hanging you out to dry, it isn't going to be what you've accumulated. It's made the difference, buddy. It's going to be what you give away. And I've had the opportunity to give a little away by picking up them ashtrays and making that 12-step call. These are the things that I didn't really recognize nor know at the first AA meeting that I attended. It goes without saying. As a matter of fact, the second meeting I went to was damn near my last.
The second meeting that I went to happened to be over in Pasadena. Where the hell else would I go to the second meeting? And in Pasadena, this old-timers group that met over there. You had to be sober 10 years to read the steps in those days. And that night, the speaker, he was an old-timer. He'd been sober 137 years, you know, one of them old-timers. He stood up there in front of that group that night and he showed a great big picture of himself. It was a great big blown-up mugshot taken when he's doing time in the L.A. County Jail. And the point that he was trying to get across was, look at me when I was drinking and look at me now. But I look at Artie and I look at that picture and I thought, hey, I better jump. No doubt about it. This AA outfit ages the hell out of these guys. I gotta get out of here. And the next day I went out and bought a pint of whiskey. I took a drink out of it and I threw it away. And from that day to this, it hasn't been necessary to take a drink. And he asked me why, and I say, why? Because God moves in strange and mysterious ways. Because I'm willing to be willing. Because I went out and I went to a lot of meetings. And I went through all the throes that anybody else did. I went through the job syndrome when I had the problem of 3 years and 2 months. And it was tearing me up, and I had to make a decision to stay or to move. And then I went through the problem of wanting to go out and making demands to everybody. And everybody in my life that I'd hurt. And they said, you will directly affect the lives of a minimum of 20 people. And in my life, there's 20 multiplied by 20 I've either hurt, used, or abused. And at the top of that list was my people. I wanted to go home and see my mother. I want to say, baby, Jesus, I'm sorry. But 2 years before I got to the program, she's killed in a car wreck. And it bothered me. Until one evening, I heard that serenity prayer read. I must have heard it 50 times before that, but it didn't ring the bell. And it said, accept the things you cannot change, and it came down. And it said, accept it, for you can't change it. For all the prayers and the tears in the world, you can't change it. Your right arm thrown in. That's the way it is. That's wreckage of the past, Norm. And I know. And I don't believe that it's rationalization, it's fact. It's tough enough to live today with today's merchandise, let alone trying to do something about something that happened years ago that I can do nothing about. I've got to move it out. It's wreckage of the past. And I know deep inside, nobody goes forever. Someday I make the shot and I check in and I'll say, baby, Jesus, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for all the tears and the heartbreak, the grief and the misery.
But it got a lot better after you left because I met a group of people and they called themselves Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to tell all the folks out here tonight, all the new ones, that after you get to the program, every day is a holiday and every meal is a banquet. But that isn't the way it is. What we give you is the equipment to stand out there, buddy, and be counted just like everybody else. Meet your responsibilities, Norm, just like everybody else. If you're big enough to take the good days, you got to be big enough to take the salty. When it rains out there and it comes down hard and heavy, be big enough to accept it for what it is. It's awfully difficult. In 1962, for example, I stood out there as I walked out of St. Luke's Hospital and I said, Jesus Christ, why? God, why you got to cut me up again? I'm in sober 8 years now. Why you got to do this to me? Why me? I forgot to remember who I was and where I come from. Instead of standing there crying to poor mouth Norm about what you didn't get, why don't you thank him for what you have? Instead of standing there crying, why don't you take a second out of your busy life and look down the street? What do you see? You see a man carrying a load 10 times the size of yours, and the only difference between you and he is he carries his with great dignity. He doesn't find it necessary to cry to poor mouth about what he didn't get. He thanked the man for what he had, and he says to me, all right, Norm, buddy, what do you got? And I say, my friend, I got a lot. I got a hell of a lot more than I had when I got here. It don't take a mathematical giant to figure it out. When I got here, I had nothing. And any way you want to cut it, nothing from nothing leaves nothing. So every loving thing I got now is a lot better than I had when I got here. I woke up now for 18 and a half years and made the decision of which way I want to live. If I don't get any more than that, I'm overpaid. For 18 and a half years, I've been able to walk down the sunny side of the street. There'll be guys that'll never cut it. There's going to be guys that are going to walk down the street of booze and fantasy and busted dreams and broken hearts and tears by the bucketful, and they're going to die there. I'm overpaid. I've walked down the sunny side now for a long time. In the morning, I make the decision. In the morning, I leave, and I know I don't have to justify my existence out there to none of them. I'm not coming from behind. The greatest thing a man will ever own, my self-respect. I'll walk that street, and I'll be respected. And I'll get in my car after a day's work, and I'll drive home to my house, and I'll walk in, and I'll see my red-headed woman who's there, and I will be respected by her. Because once again, I'm her old man. And I'll be respected by them bandits, the few that are still left living at my house, because I'm their father. Nobody will cry at my house today
because her old man was drunk and tore it up. I had heard a kid of mine scream at me for years for me not to hit their mother. I've watched them go from small ones into big ones, and I've sent them to school to get smart. And I got a daughter 1 year I took downtown and bought her first pair of high-heeled shoes. I walked in the store with her arm in arm, and she was just a chicken. And she put on them shoes and stood up, and she's now a woman. And she looked at me, and I looked at her, and there was respect. She respected me because I was her old man, not for where I'd been or where I was trying to go, but for what I represented that day. And I respected her because she was a little girl that'd grown up. And in these moments, when the man says, "Norm, what do you got?" That's what I got, and a lot more. I got an older girl 3 years ago that I got married. I sent out 400 invitations, and 350 people came. I can remember the day that I could send out 400 invitations for people to come to see me shot, and nobody comes, you know. But that day, 350 people came, and I'm standing there with his little tiny girl, and I'm looking out there in that sea of people, and I was part of it, and it just tore me up, because I can remember the day I could stand in a room full of people, and I stood there all by myself. Lonely Jesus is the alcoholic. But not that day. I stood there with her, and when the music started, I took her down the aisle, and I gave her to that big jackass she married. Before old jackass ever got there, it was just me and this little tiny girl. And as I looked out at the people, I saw 60, 70 guys from Alcoholics Anonymous. And they're all sitting there, and they're looking sharp. And the tears maybe in a few of their eyes. And the story that's in their eyes is the important thing, as it looks out and it says, "Norm, buddy, I see you. Jesus, you look sharp, Norm." "Yeah, Norm. Too bad. Too bad the rest of the people of this church don't know you, huh? Too bad they don't know where you come from or what it took you to bring it. Like this, you want to shout to them all and say, 'Charlie, Jesus, yeah.' Too bad they don't know us, huh? Too bad they don't know my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. God love them. But for the grace of God and these friends and Alcoholics Anonymous and that redheaded woman, buddy, I could have missed it all. Thanks a million. God love you all."